Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies program titled The Dark Races of the Pacific World, Reading Race, Immigration, and Empire in Pauline Hopkins and the Colored American Magazine. Our speaker is Edley Wong, professor of English at the University of Maryland. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, African American Studies program director, Louis Chude Sokai.
Today, we're gathered to meet and hear the work of a scholar whose work I'm quite impressed by and grateful for, and that's Edley Wong, professor of English and director of the Center for Literary and Comparative Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park. I'm grateful for the work because Professor Wong is of a generation of scholars that, well, for whom the interactions between racial groups, racial formations, and indeed among diasporas are central to how race is understood as a product of multiple and multiply differentiated histories of empire, slavery, labor, and capitalism. Her work has been focused on producing, quote, a comparative analytic for understanding American race, racialization, and identity formation, end quote. And as such, it breaks new ground in bringing, quote, Pacific Rim studies to bear on Black Atlantic studies, end quote. And I'm referring specifically to her fantastic second book, 2015's Racial Reconstruction, Black Inclusion, Chinese Exclusion, and the Fictions of Citizenship, NYU Press. Her first book, 2009's Neither Fugitive Nor Free, Atlantic Slavery, Freedom Suits, and the Legal Culture of Travel, it engages the curious history of freedom suits, those legal cases by Black slaves against their masters and mistresses once they'd traveled from slave territory to putatively or ambiguously free zones. Her work is interdisciplinary, but remarkably so in its use of the law and legal history, in addition to literary critical studies, studies in racial formation, and of course, African American and Asian American literature. Anyway, I'll stop now and ask you to warmly welcome to Boston University Professor Edley Wong.
Well, thank you all for coming out, and thank you so much for that lovely introduction and for this wonderful invitation. So without further ado, let me just begin. So I've broken my talk into a number of parts. So part one, reading race, immigration, and empire. In The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois famously proclaimed, quote, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. The relation of the darker to the lighter races of men in Asia, in Africa, in America, and the islands of the sea, end quote. Du Bois began formulating his world color line thesis in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Plessy v. Ferguson. 2 years later, the U.S. began its Pacific Empire with the annexation of Hawaii, followed by Puerto Rico and Guam after the Spanish-American War. The Philippines followed in 1902 after the Philippine-American War. Overseas expansion brought white supremacy and colonial rule into alignment. It also threw into greater relief the contradictions of U.S. citizenship and national identity during the era of legal segregation. In The Present Outlook for the Dark Races of Mankind, 1900, Du Bois writes, quotes, the colored population of our land is, through this new imperial policy, about to be doubled by our ownership of Puerto Rico and Hawaii, our protectorate of Cuba, and the conquest of the Philippines, end quote. For Du Bois, the struggle against racial segregation and white racial hegemony at home extends beyond the black-white binary to encompass the global, indeed imperial, relations between white and non-white. In thus expanding the color line, Du Bois imagined a shared history of struggle that linked Black Americans with the quote-unquote dark races of the Asia-Pacific. At the dawn of the new century, Plessy v. Ferguson proved that the Reconstruction Amendments and the extension of nominal citizenship to Black freedmen did not break the constitutive link between whiteness and citizenship. Moreover, the ongoing racial exclusion of Chinese in all so-called, quote-unquote, Asiatic races affirmed the whiteness or Americanization of more desirable European immigrants. The 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, the nation's first racialized immigration ban, barred the entry of the Chinese labor migrant and prohibited Chinese naturalization to citizenship. Periodic expansions to Chinese exclusion, including its extension to the Asia-Pacific territories, specifically Hawaii in 1898 and the Philippines in 1899 and then as law in 1902, further exacerbated the racial cleavages within U.S. citizenship, provoking additional debate over what constituted membership in the expanding republic. Thus, the law and politics of Chinese exclusion held manifold implications for the ongoing struggles over black citizenship and national identity. In the decades leading to Plessy, mainstream U.S. culture often represented blacks and Chinese as analogous and unresolvable national problems, positioning them as chiasmatic figures of racial difference. These racial logics are exemplified in Justice John Marshall Harlan's celebrated lone dissent from the Plessy majority. Harlan disputed the constitutionality of black-white segregation by way of comparison to the alien status of the quote-unquote Chinese race. He imagined a different cross-racial scene to reveal the racial inconsistency of the Louisiana statute, which permitted Chinese aliens to travel in white public coaches while banning black citizens from the same privilege. There is a race so different from our own that we do not permit those belonging to it to become citizens of the United States. I allude to the Chinese race. But, by the statute in question, a Chinaman can ride in the same passenger coach with the white citizens of the United States, while citizens of the black race in Louisiana are yet declared to be criminals, liable to imprisonment if they ride in a public coach occupied by citizens of the white race. In urging the court not to abandon black citizens to Jim Crow, Harlan sought to combat the sentiment of alienism directed against black Americans by emphasizing Chinese difference as a race reclassified by the Chinese Exclusion Act as, quote, aliens ineligible to citizenship, end quote. For Harlan, the Chinese alien troubles the distinction between white and colored races mandated by law and gesture to the various categories of race and gender-based differential inclusion into citizenship. In disputing the racial caste legislation upheld in Plessy, Harlan proposed a different line of demarcation between black and white citizens and Chinese aliens who were deemed politically inassimilable to the nation. His dissent enfolded black racial difference within the embrace of national identity. Yet this romance of black-white national reunification came at the expense of another prescribed race. The distinct yet related discourses of Chinese and black racial difference shaped the meaning of U.S. citizenship and later struggles over national inclusion as black writers and activists began to think more expansively about black identity formation in comparative and transnational racial contexts. This talk recasts the struggles over black citizenship in relation to the politics of Chinese immigration and naturalization rights in the U.S., Chinese immigration and naturalization rights and U.S. colonial expansion into the Asia-Pacific. Specifically, it mines the pages of the most influential of early black journals, The Colored American Magazine, and the lesser-studied works of one of its most celebrated editors, Pauline Hopkins, to investigate the complex cross-racial and inter-ethnic tensions and alliances that occur in black writing from this period. Gretchen Murphy and John Grusser have drawn renewed attention to the broad range of CAM publications on the Asia-Pacific, from Frank R. Stewart's short fictions about the U.S. military occupation of the Philippines to the rather enigmatic scholar S.E.F.C.C. Hamado's ethnographic accounts of Hawaiians and Samoans. These writings contribute to an emerging black American discourse on the Pacific as Asia became more geographically and geopolitically significant over the course of the 19th century. Hopkins' literary experimentation with Asian figures and her writings on the Asia-Pacific anticipate the contours of the more utopian coalitional politics we find in the writings of later black internationalist figures. Imagining black American connectedness to foreign nationals and colonial subjects in the Asia-Pacific formed the, quote, emotive foundations for the organization of material internationalist practices, end quote, as Etsuko Takatani argues in the Black Pacific narrative. These writings responded in agonistic and complementary ways to the complex relational nature of Black and Chinese, and more broadly, Asian and Asian American racialization within Du Bois's World Color Line. The following sections insist on relational and comparative readings and chart some of the earlier literary histories of Afro-Asian encounter and exchange. So part two, The Colored American Magazine and Debating Chinese versus the Negroes. Debates over extending the Chinese Exclusion Act to the newly acquired Pacific territories and expanding the Chinese immigration ban to encompass other Asian nationalities widened the scope of discussions on race and national belonging in Black periodicals like the CAM. Published in Boston, the CAM was the most widely read Black American journal in the first decade of the 20th century, and Hopkins was the magazine's best-known female personality. She served as editor until 1903, shortly after Booker T. Washington acquired the publication and before its relocation to New York. Over the course of its 9-year run, from 1900 to 1909, the magazine carried a range of editorials, essays, serial fiction, and poetry aimed at cultivating a well-informed readership conversant with current and international events. During Hopkins' editorial tenure and after it, the CAM expressed a range of opinions addressed to the divisive progressive-era issue of immigration control, especially in relation to Asian immigrants to the U.S. These editorials offer a unique vantage on how Black Americans came to understand and position themselves in relation to the politics of East-West relations and U.S. foreign and domestic policies on the Asia-Pacific. Some articles sought to reinforce the line between colored Americans and racialized aliens, while others channeled the spirit of Du Bois's burgeoning international politics by identifying Blacks, Chinese, and other Asians as numbering among the stigmatized, quote-unquote, darker races of the Western world. In a 1904 essay entitled Evils of European Immigration, Black politician and publisher John L. Waller expressed anxieties over the influx of new immigrants that were not unusual for his time. Waller anticipates the discourse of securitization popularized in sensationalized urban exposés like Jacob Riis's hugely popular How the Other Half Lives, Studies Among the Tenements of New York, which publicized the perils of foreign immigration. However, Waller did not share Riis's antipathy towards the Chinese. He viewed the Chinese as, quote, peaceful and law-abiding, unlike the, quote, fiery and violent anarchists from Europe, end quote. Other voices from the CAM were even more critical of the racialized bans against the Chinese under current U.S. immigration policies. They linked Chinese exclusion to the global diffusion of white supremacy as national ideology and colonial practice. For example, Black educator and writer Benjamin Griffith Brawley's poem New Wars critically juxtaposes Chinese exclusion against U.S. imperial war in the Philippines. Quote, "Ye hoot the yellow Mongol from your land, but forth to regions all his own ye go, to reap the riches of his overflow." In August 1905, a regular current events column entitled The Way of This World welcomed the recent Chinese boycott of U.S. goods, protesting the indefinite extension of of Chinese exclusion in the U.S. and its Pacific territories. Sutton Griggs echoed the sentiment in a supplement to his self-published novel, A Hindered Hand, from 1905, which positioned the Chinese boycott in a broader revolutionary awakening of the darker world. Griggs cautions, quote, "We have a hint of what will happen in the awakened darker world and the boycott of American goods by the Chinese because of the rude treatment by American customs officials of unoffending Chinese, a treatment born of the spirit of race hatred," end quote. Likewise, the CAM editorial condemned the government's persecution of Chinese immigrants and advocated for Chinese American citizenship. Quote, "The Chinese are as much entitled to citizenship in America as the Greek and Poland Jew," end quote. A September installment viewed the, quote, "infamous Chinese Exclusion Act," end quote, as a reaction against the country's changing demography. Quote, the homogeneity of America is being destroyed. Its sympathy is becoming broadened so that no far distant time we will see a new nation of men, distinct perhaps in color, yet one in spirit and before the law, end quote. Debates and discussions over restrictive U.S. immigration policies against Asia periodically resurfaced throughout the CAM's 9-year print run. As the U.S. began to consolidate its Pacific empire, some writers and activists began couching the question of black political and social rights in relation to reinvigorated debates over extending Chinese exclusion to other undesirable Asiatics like the Japanese. These black imaginings of Asia, as Helen Jung argues, expressed a range of, quote, negotiations with the limits and disappointments of black citizenship, end quote. By 1907, the U.S. had extended Chinese exclusion in perpetuity with no terminal date, and the country turned its attention to Japanese immigration. The Russo-Japanese War, 1904-5, radically altered the political landscape of the Pacific. Japan became the strongest maritime power in the region. It re-energized Yellow Peril anxieties over another wave of Asiatic immigrants flooding the U.S. and its recently acquired Pacific territories. The CAM, under the new editorship of Fred Randolph Moore, took this opportunity to revisit the history of Chinese exclusion. Quote, after many years, the same question arises, but from a different cause. And the American people find themselves confronted with the admission of the Asiatic, not alone the Chinese, but associated with his very near relative, the Japanese, end quote. The articles Moore republished show how the popular association of the Chinese question with the Negro problem continued to shape Afro-Asian race relations in the new century. Earlier debates over the Chinese question centered on the viability of Chinese racial fitness for citizenship. They often cite the progress or lack thereof of recently enfranchised black freedmen as a vital point of comparison. In 1907, Moore asked his readers to again study, quote, the following articles reproduced from several Boston dailies of February 1891. So 1907, asking us to revisit articles from 1891. On the subject, quote, Chinese versus the Negroes, end quote, a matter which engaged public attention at that time, end quote. These editorials first appeared in the context of the divisive national debate over the 1892 Geary Act. The most restrictive of all modifications to the original Chinese Exclusion Act, the controversial Geary Act required all Chinese labor migrants to secure certificates of residence, making noncompliance punishable by a maximum 1-year term of imprisonment at hard labor, followed by deportation. The reprinted 1891 articles run the gamut of positions on Chinese immigration, ending with the words of Samuel R. Scottron endorsing Chinese exclusion. Perhaps indicative of the new, more nationalist direction of the CAM after Hopkins's forced departure, Moore's prefacing remarks tout the virtues of Scottron's pro-exclusion stance. In the early 1890s, Scottron's position on Chinese exclusion was not uncommon, especially when addressing the racializing logic of mainstream media on the quote-unquote Negro problem and Chinese question. As Jung observes, racial uplift ideology and its narratives of, quote, black moral, political, and cultural development, end quote, inadvertently reinforce the, quote, Orientalist logic of the anti-Chinese movement, end quote. For example, one of the reprinted editorials asks readers to consider, quote, representatives of the Chinese and Negro races we have actually in this country, end quote, to determine, quote, if the one is any better fitted for American citizenship than the other, end quote. The popularity of this kind of competing and racially homogenizing discourse encouraged black writers like Scottron to assert their racial legal distinctiveness as non-white subjects. At the onset of the Philippine-American War, however, Scotron again returned to the subject, expanding his editorial into a short pamphlet publication entitled Chinese versus the Negroes as American Citizens, 1899. In January 1900, the Colored American newspaper recommended to its readers, quote, a neat little pamphlet published by Mr. S.R. Scotron, which has much in it that deserves careful attention and is productive of thought, end quote. Like Du Bois, Scotron had begun reframing the so-called Chinese question more broadly as part of an emerging discourse on race in American empire. In different but complementary ways, Scotron and Du Bois moved towards this global frame in their efforts to grapple with the situation of Black Americans in the U.S. Unlike its first iteration in 1891, Scotron's 1899 pamphlet revisits the national policy of Chinese exclusion in relation to U.S. overseas expansion, aligning itself with the growing Black anti-imperialist effort. As Kevin Gaines argues, quote, anti-Black violence throughout the South, fueled by the racist rhetoric of imperialists and white supremacists in Congress, end quote, heavily influenced Black opinion on the vexed national debate over Philippine independence. For Du Bois, this reframing took shape in his World Color Line thesis. Its earliest iteration appeared in a speech before the third annual meeting of the American Negro Academy on December 27th, 1899, the same year as Scotron's pamphlet, as the country marked its first year of war in the Philippines. In the present outlook for the dark races of mankind, Du Bois suggested, quote, it is but natural for us to consider that our race question is a purely national and local affair. Yet a glance over the world at the dawn of the new century will convince us that this is but the beginning of the problem, the color line belts the world, end quote. The editorial decision to focus on Scotron's earlier anti-Chinese editorial might be read as part of a broader strategy by Washington and his Tuskegee machine to impose, according to Gaines, quote, an illusory consensus by suppressing Black dissent, end quote. Scotron's pamphlet returns to the nationalist rhetoric that characterized his earlier editorial, but it radically modifies his anti-Chinese position. Since he first addressed the Chinese question in 1891, Scotron notes that, quote, the United States has acquired territory very largely inhabited by Chinese and other Asiatic races. And the question becomes important immediately to the American people as to what policy shall be pursued in the future with reference to these races, end quote. In 1899, Du Bois pondered the same question, although he saw in America's, quote, new imperial policy, end quote, the conditions for the emerging alliances that would ensure its overthrow. He writes, quote, Negro and Filipino, Indian and Puerto Rican, Cuban, Hawaiian, all must stand united under the stars and stripes for an America that knows no color line, end quote. As Amy Kaplan argues, Du Bois seized on the, quote, utopian potential in imperial expansion to imagine the rise of new forms of collectivity, end quote, to overthrow the boundaries of color and caste, nation, and colony. However, the debates over extending Chinese exclusion to the newly acquired Pacific territories and expanding the domestic immigration ban to other Asian nationalities also helped reinvigorate a Black discourse of national belonging. Like Du Bois, Scotron positions Black Americans at the vanguard of this political struggle. The Afro-Asian antagonism from his 1891 editorial gives way to the 1899 pamphlet's new emphasis on affinity and alliance. Scotron's endorsement of Black political sympathy for the racially excluded Chinese also allows him to make a more forceful assertion for national belonging, just as Plessy began undermining the political meaning of Black citizenship. Scotron writes, quote, the hour has come when he, meaning the Negro, may sit somewhat complacently in his own secure place in the nation and discuss the desirability of admitting other races to the full enjoyment of American citizenship. And it is so to be hoped that his own experience will tend to clarify the atmosphere surrounding him and enable him to deal justly by and be merciful to others situated in many respects in a position which was once his own, end quote. Scotron asks his readers to reconsider the nation's ban against Chinese immigration and naturalization in light of the racial ideologies that had once justified racial slavery and black exclusion from citizenship. Yet, he continues to locate black Americans as still more, quote, readily assimilable into the body politic, end quote, than the Chinese, especially with regards to the, quote, Christian principles and philosophies, end quote, upon which American institutions, in his words, are builded. U.S. empire, especially in the Pacific, became central to these efforts to grapple with the situation of black Americans in the U.S., In a series of opinions known as the Insular Cases, the U.S. Supreme Court began devising a new doctrine that positioned these unincorporated territories and their subjects in a liminal space both inside and outside the Constitution. These decisions were a product and expression of progressive-era anxieties over the, quote, alien races of these foreign lands and the, quote, unquote, hydra-headed peril they posed to the integrity of this, quote, state, the body politic, citizenship, and the family, as Amy Kaplan argues. By positioning these unincorporated territories as belonging to, but not, quote, a part of, the U.S., the Supreme Court reaffirmed the uneven, racialized application of the Constitution, indeed the legal framework established in Plessy, as it judged the subjects of these territories to be U.S. citizens in matters of discipline and taxation, yet ineligible to full protection under the 14th Amendment. These resemblances were not lost upon commentators like Du Bois, who continued to recalibrate his world color line thesis over the course of his lifetime. In The Color Line Belts the World, Du Bois writes, quote, the policy of expansion simply means world problems of the color line, end quote. So part three, Pauline Hopkins, Thelma Gordon, and the Dark Races of the 20th Century. Du Bois's influential color line thesis repositioned the so-called Negro problem as an essential element of a far broader and indeed global struggle of the, quote, dark races of the world, end quote. Against the rising tide of progressive era white nativism, black writers and activists drew upon the intersecting histories of black and Asian racializations to craft powerful critiques of the U.S. racial state, active in the perpetuation of social inequities through the manipulation of race and racial categories, as Michael Omi and Howard Wynant have shown. Moreover, U.S. attitudes towards the Pacific Rim, especially Japan and China, began to shift subtly at the turn of the century. As Hua Xu notes, quote, after an extended period of contempt in the late 19th century, the early decades of the 20th century saw public feelings of exotic fascination rise as China was recast as a rich, unexplored mystery to Western observers, end quote. For writers like Hopkins and Du Bois, this burgeoning interest in Asia found a politicized expression in various forms of Afro-Orientalism. According to Bill Mullen, Afro-Orientalism, as distinct from Edward Said's Orientalism, might be understood as, quote, a counter-discourse to modernity, which simultaneously threatened blacks and Asians with perpetual subjugation, exploitation, and division, and yet, dialectically, made both visible and urgent the need for Afro-Asian unity, end quote. In this period of transition, Hopkins began advancing a more internationalist outlook as her writings forged stronger links between racial justice, class struggle, and anti-colonialism. According to Ira Dworkin, Hopkins's developing anti-racist and anti-colonial politics might be traced to her early criticism of Roosevelt's bellicose foreign policies in the Philippines during and after the Philippine-American War. Hopkins began experimenting with a rhetoric of inter-ethnic political identifications in her early detective fiction, Thelma Gordon, 1900, and in the ethnographic writing she published in the Atlanta-based Voice of the Negro, immediately upon her departure from the CAM. Dworkin writes that Hopkins expressed increasing frustration with the new direction of the CAM and its tendency to limit, quote, the narrow confines of the race question as affecting solely the Afro-American, end quote. Hopkins's five-part series, The Dark Races of the 20th Century, explicitly recasts the issue of black citizenship in relation to U.S. colonial and neocolonial relations in the Asia-Pacific. Like Scottrin, Hopkins was deeply invested in racial uplift. As scholars from Helen Jung to Eric Gardner, Hollis Robbins, and Janet Neary have argued, black writers invested in uplift ideology often made orientalizing references to Asia and Asian immigrants as points of comparison to black American struggles in the U.S. However, Hopkins offers a different, and might I argue, Afro-Orientalist approach, one that built upon Du Bois's emerging world color line thesis. Her lesser-studied writings radically expand monogenetic theory into a framework for anti-racist alliance across the world color line, and they anticipate the tenor of later Afro-Asian internationalist writings. Hopkins introduced these ideas in Thelma Gordon and later broadened and developed them in The Dark Races of the 20th Century. In Thelma Gordon, Hopkins first experimented with Asiatic figures, emphasizing their disruptive relation to the black-white binary of dominant U.S. race relations in the wake of Plessy. Like Hopkins's other efforts at genre fiction, Thelma Gordon has been celebrated for its appropriation and repurposing of popular magazine genre conventions, in this case, detective fiction, for the purposes of social critique. An intertwined critique of race and empire lie at the heart of Hopkins's frame narrative. It takes place at the, quote, Beacon Street residence of Dr. William Thornton, end quote, where the exclusive Canterbury Club of Boston has gathered for its monthly meeting to discuss the topic, quote, expansion, its effect upon the future development of the Anglo-Saxon, end quote. Not surprisingly, the white jurists, politicians, and theologians, numbering among the club's distinguished membership, quote, painted in glowing colors the advantages to be gained by the increase of wealth and the exalted position which expansion would give the United States in the councils of the great governments of the world, end quote. However, Thornton, an open advocate of miscegenation, poses a counterproposition to this rousing endorsement of the white man's burden. Quote, did you ever think that in spite of our prejudices against amalgamation, some of our descendants, indeed many of them, will inevitably intermarry among those far-off tribes of dark-skinned peoples if they become a part of this great union, end quote. In fiction, Hopkins explores another facet of America's new imperial policy that also preoccupied Du Bois and Scottrin. Thornton's arguments anticipate the theory of monogenesis that Hopkins later developed in Of One Blood, or The Hidden Shelf, the last of the three novels serialized in the CAM. Thornton proclaims to his rapt audience, quote, black, white, green, yellow, nothing will prevent intermarriage. So it is with the sons of Adam ever since, through the law of heredity, which makes all of us one common family, end quote. To illustrate his point, Thornton relates the circumstances related to the tragic death of Captain Jonathan Gordon, quote, a retired sea captain formerly engaged in the East India trade, end quote, whose ancestors had numbered among the, quote, old New England Puritans who'd come over in the Mayflower, end quote. Gordon's marriage to his first wife, Isabel Franklin, quote, brought to him the money which mended the broken fortunes of the Gordon house and restored this old Puritan stock to its rightful position, end quote. However, Gordon soon discovers the truth about Isabel's racial ancestry when, to his horror and shame, their third child, the much-desired male heir, is born, quote, dark as a mulatto with the characteristic features of the Negro, end quote. After Isabel's death, Gordon determines to leave his fortune to the white son he sires from a second marriage, removing his two black daughters, Jeanette and Thelma, from their, quote-unquote, birthright. In the face of, quote, cold cruelty of relentless caste prejudice, end quote, a vengeful Jeanette plots parricide and the restitution of her mother's legacy. However, her revenge is forestalled when another commits the grisly homicide in her stead. Talma, who remains unaware of her mother's black identity, finds her way to Thornton Sanitarium, broken in body and spirit. Under Thornton's care, Talma unravels the murder mystery. Another patient at the sanitarium, a man, quote, fresh from the California gold fields, end quote, a landscape intimately associated with the Chinese presence in the U.S. and suffering from advanced tuberculosis, confesses to the crime. Calling himself Simon Cameron, the man remains a racial enigma until he finally identifies himself as, quote, an East Indian. Like Jeanette, Cameron had sought vengeance against the avaricious man who had partnered and then betrayed and murdered his father simply to, quote, satisfy his lust for gold, end quote. And while East Indian villains are familiar figures in the popular detective fictions of writers like Wilkie Collins and Arthur Conan Doyle, Hopkins's portrayal of Cameron is largely sympathetic given our insights into Gordon's character, especially in his treatment of the now-dead Jeanette. As representative non-white characters, Jeanette and Cameron are unified in their subversive desire for vengeance against Gordon, whose, quote, pure Puritan ancestral fortune is revealed to be founded on racial violence and imperial venture. According to Cameron, quote, Captain Gordon was no better than a pirate, end quote, calling to mind the piracy of the African slave trade. In the denouement of the murder mystery, Hopkins emphasizes the long durée of class formations in northern cities as inseparable from the histories of anti-black racial violence and Western imperialism in the East. Hopkins' Afro-Orientalist critique of race and empire is framed by an exterior tale that also radically challenges the post-Plessy U.S. color line. In its final moments, the story pairs Jeanette's violent rejection of domestic patriarchy with the public revelation of Talma and Thornton's marriage, which offers another perspective on the politicization of the domestic sphere. Unlike Charles Chestnut's The House Behind the Cedars, Hopkins ends Talma Gordon with a successful and publicly recognized reproductive interracial marriage, one that redresses the failures of the preceding generation. This intermarriage, in her words, also confirms the theory of monogenesis espoused at the outset of the tale, for the white and dark races have indeed become, quote, one common family. In the dark races of the 20th century, Hopkins radically expanded her theory of monogenesis to encompass all the quote-unquote darker races of the world, as U.S. overseas expansion paved the way for the diffusion of white supremacist ideologies. Hopkins writes, quote, in this study of the dark races actually living today upon the globe, the reader or student is deeply impressed with the infinite variety of mixtures in these races. The very mingling of races proves the theory of, quote-unquote, one blood. Indeed, the principle that the human species is one cannot be disputed, and all men that inhabit the earth are but varieties of this one species, end quote. Hopkins draws from an earlier tradition of black ethnological writings. In Fugitive Science, Britt Russert argues that the ethnologies of earlier figures such as Robert Benjamin Lewis and Hosea Easton blended science and scripture to advance a monogenetic theory of racial origins that imaginatively mapped descent and genealogy across the African diaspora. Hopkins's Dark Races, however, dispenses with a distanced ethnographic perspective and playfully recasts Du Bois's world color line thesis and the politically charged rhetoric of racial perils. Quote, God hath made of one blood all the nations and men for to dwell on the face of this earth. But the sons of Japheth are stiff-necked people and prone to improve upon God's work if possible. And so we have in opening of the 20th century perils, yellow and black, born alone on an unreasoning insanity on the question of color, end quote. Her sardonic tone is unmistakable, and it offsets an ethnographic medium that had long fostered racist ideologies, from comparative anatomy to polygenesis. In this fashion, Hopkins also confronts and manipulates the racialized yellow peril trope, the discourse of racialized threat that had variously marked Asian Americans and Asian immigrants as dangerous outsiders to the nation. In the third essay, which is entitled, quote, The Yellow Race, Siam, China, Japan, Korea, Tibet, Hopkins's quasi-ethnographic observations regarding the peoples and practices of Eastern Asia are often made in reference to domestic concerns over U.S. race relations. Her discussions of East Asian countries are inflected through the recent history of Chinese exclusion and national anxieties over the so-called Chinese question. For Hopkins, the nativist antipathy directed against Chinese immigrants in the U.S. is an illustrative example of the rising tide of white supremacy throughout the globe. She writes, quote, the great movement of the 20th century is seen in the banding together of all white races as against the darker races, and in the Geary Law, which excludes Chinese from the United States, end quote. As Hopkins notes, Japan's surprising victory over Russia in the recent Russo-Japanese War reignited 19th century fears over the imagined threat of an Asiatic inundation of the U.S. Quote, since the war between Russia and Japan began, there's been great talk of the Yellow Peril, end quote. For Du Bois, the Russo-Japanese War signaled a turning point in the struggle against the world color line, one that revised the vanguard position that he and Scotron once claimed for black Americans. In The Color Line Belts the World, 1906, Du Bois writes, quote, the awakening of the yellow race is certain, and the awakening of the brown and black races will follow in time, end quote. Japan's defeat of Russia marked a new horizon of political possibilities. Quote, for the first time in 1,000 years, a great white nation has measured arms with a colored nation and been found wanting, end quote. In Dark Races, Hopkins' sardonic tone, especially in her manipulation of the racialized discourse of Yellow Peril, is key to understanding her attitudes towards Pacific Empire and Chinese, and by extension, Japanese immigration and citizenship. Critics such as Gretchen Murphy and Yufang Chu have read these passages as justifying imperialism or as evidence of ambivalence in Hopkins's quote-unquote anti-racist internationalism. On the contrary, I read Hopkins's remarks specifically in relation to Asian exclusion as subversive social commentary. So, for example, Hopkins highlights dissonance when she quotes from Katsura Taro, the Japanese prime minister who expressed admiration for the U.S. as a model of Occidental enlightenment, and in his words, quote, justice and humanity, end quote. Hopkins was aware of the growing anti-Japanese sentiment in the U.S., and she explicitly references the history of anti-Asian violence and exclusion to destabilize the civilizational discourse of white supremacy and its teleological narrative of Occidental progress. Quote, she writes, although the Geary Law bears on its face an injustice, yet to the student it marks another milestone in the march of human progress, end quote. And she continues, centuries ago, the most civilized nations fell a prey to barbarians who overturned dynasty after dynasty and completely changed the character of races and governments, thus placing scientists at fault in the 20th century in their attempt to classify the living races of their time. Those barbarians were known to the dark races who ruled the world then as the white peril. To those white barbarians, the civilized world of today owes the supremacy of the white races. By referencing the Geary Law, meaning the Chinese Exclusion Act, in this context, Hopkins inverts the racializing rhetoric of yellow peril and Asiatic barbarism disseminated by anti-Chinese propaganda and foreign policies. Indeed, the so-called, quote, march of human progress, as she subsequently explains, is a narrative of declension in which white barbarians, her terms, the real peril, overrun the, quote, civilized nations of the darker races. This essay installment concludes with a powerful call for Afro-Asian political alliance. Quote, we wage a twofold struggle, a struggle for bread and the struggle for freedom, end quote. Through ethnography, Hopkins crafts a subversive black counter-discourse that undermines the, quote, assumptions of superiority by the Anglo-Saxon race, her words. Her sardonic manipulation of anti-Chinese yellow peril rhetoric anticipates the later work of James D. Carruthers, who was also a regular contributor to the CAM. He similarly exploited the disruptive potential of an Asiatic threat in his two-part short story, A Man They Didn't Know, which was serialized in the December 1913 and January 1914 issues of Du Bois's The Crisis. In 1910, Du Bois became the founding editor of the NAACP's magazine, which helped fill the void created by the end of the CAM. Set in an unspecified future, Carruthers' tale imagines politicized Black Americans, quote-unquote Negro soldiers, joining with anti-colonial Mexican revolutionaries and dissident Japanese Nisei and Chinese Americans in a transnational alliance against white supremacy and U.S. imperialism in Hawaii. In rewriting the plot of Yellow Peril Invasion, Carruthers challenges the multiform nature of white supremacy in its exploration of Black identifications inimical to the U.S. imperial mission of white civilization. In a similar fashion, Hopkins also emphasizes the powerful threat or peril that the darker races, once united, pose in relation to a white minority on a global scale. As Hopkins writes, quote, when we consider the fact that there are 13 million people in the world and that only about 375 million are white, or one quarter of the globe's population, we are not surprised that the dominant race dreads a dark peril and sees in every movement made by the leading representatives of the dark peoples a menace to this future prosperous existence, end quote. In The World Problem of the Color Line, Du Bois likewise raised the specter of a, quote, great coming war of races, end quote, one that yoked together the, quote, race problem of Negroes and whites in the United States and the West Indies, end quote, and the, quote, so-called yellow peril of China and Japan, end quote. Hopkins points out that the, quote, dread fear that is ever present with the Anglo-Saxon race and tugging at their very heartstrings, end quote, is the peril of racial coalition and the, quote, steady uplift of thousands of blacks, yellows, and browns, end quote. In The Dark Races of the 20th Century, Hopkins' satirical recasting of yellow peril transforms the idea of dark peril into a powerful Afro-Orientalist figure for the political unification of racialized subalterns against global white political and cultural hegemony. In her final essay installment, Hopkins argues, quote, that the ultimate desire of the Anglo-Saxon is the complete subjugation of all dark races to themselves. There's no doubt but the persistent rise of the dark men in the social scale and their wonderful increase in numbers is a course of constant menace to the accomplishments of certain designs, end quote. In these final moments, Hopkins limns the global outlines of racial capitalism, a systemic practice of Western economic exploitation and underdevelopment based on racism and forms of racialization. From these united, quote, darker races, Hopkins issues a call in her final sentence for men, quote, who will teach the Anglo-Saxon that all men were created equal and that all men are not white men, end quote. So the final part, in conclusion, the kinship of the dark races of the globe. Hopkins' lesser-known ethnographic writings on the dark races as united in struggle against the world color line anticipated the tenor Afro-Orientalist discourse that developed later in the century. These efforts to think through Afro-Asian linkages and connections limn both the possibilities and limits of cross-racial and inter-ethnic alliances. For example, James Marmaduke Body's The Ethnology of the Japanese Race, published in 1905 in the CAM, boldly asserted that the dark races of Africa and Asia to be of one ancient, quote, oceanic Negro family, end quote, claiming the Japanese and Chinese to be of, quote, African, therefore Negro origin, end quote. By emphasizing the ancient histories of kinship and racial amalgamation across the African and Asian continents, Body, like Hopkins, both confronts and manipulates the, quote, hegemony of scientific racism during the Age of Empire. As Britt Russert argues, these, quote, constructed genealogies of speculative kinship, end quote, perform important reparative work, forging connections across the rifts and racial divisions of polygenetic theories popular at that time, and popularized in particular by the American School of Ethnography. The idea of Afro-Asian kinship, or what Lisa Lowe calls intimacies, emerged as a minor yet persistent theme in African-American and Asian writings, from Du Bois's much maligned 1928 utopian romance Dark Princess to perhaps lesser-known Chinese-American novelist H.T. Tsang's 1937 And China Has Hands. That novel features a mixed-race Afro-Chinese protagonist named Pearl Chang. Seeking freedom from racial persecution, Tsang's character leaves the South for New York City only to confront the anti-Black racism of other Chinese Americans. Upon discovery of Chang's Black racial heritage, one character declares, quote, "We Chinese are dark enough and don't want to become any darker," end quote, in Tsang's adaptation of Du Bois's, quote, "shadow of a color line within a color line" from Dark Princess. America's Pacific Empire ensured the global diffusion of the white supremacist ideologies that Plessy v. Ferguson solidified as U.S. law. These transitional years remained pivotal to Du Bois's lifelong thinking about cross-racial and inter-ethnic relations and political solidarities even after Bandung, 1955. Addressed to the, quote, "people of China and Africa," Du Bois's 1959 China and Africa speech envisions the global alliance of the, quote, "yellow and Black races," end quote, in the movement towards Western decolonization. Quote, "China is flesh of your flesh and blood of your blood," he proclaimed, incarnating his internationalist politics in the powerfully evocative language of racial kinship, or of one blood, to quote Hopkins. Du Bois thus charts another trajectory of political possibilities as the civil rights movement began dismantling what Plessy had long enshrined in American law and society. Desegregation in the U.S. and decolonization in Asia and Africa were vital aspects of a global freedom struggle against the world color line. Du Bois's utopian expression of Afro-Asian kinship offers perhaps a fitting culmination to this long literary trajectory of imagining cross-racial and inter-ethnic solidarities in times of crisis. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Edley Wong, professor of English at the University of Maryland. Professor Wong's lecture was titled "The Dark Races of the Pacific World: Reading Race, Immigration, and Empire" in Pauline Hopkins and the Colored American magazine. It was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director Louis Chude Sokai. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarr. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.